from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Nobody could accuse State Representative Ian Mackey of having an uneventful 8 years in the Missouri House. But now that the Clayton Democrats' tenure in the General Assembly's lower chamber is coming to an end, he's reflecting on his governmental service and the future of the Democratic Party. Mackey joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about his experience in Jefferson City. So let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio today, he is the Democratic State Representative for Missouri's beautiful 99th House District.
Ian Mackey.
Thank you for joining us. This is, I guess, your exit interview, your state legislative political obituary.
Swan song.
Swan song.
Here we go.
You came to the Missouri House in 2019. What do you think has changed over the last 7+ years?
Oh, gosh. We went through COVID. We went through January 6th. We went through so much turmoil, it seems, over the last several years. One thing that hasn't really changed is the issues we argue and debate about down in Jefferson City, at least the big ones that make the news. Still fighting about abortion, still fighting about LGBT rights, still fighting about taxes, of course. Schools, the issues haven't really changed. People have changed because of term limits, that we came in with so many folks in 2019 and we're leaving with, I feel like, maybe a third of those or maybe even a quarter of those folks after 8 years. Relationships change. I would say on the whole, it goes by so fast. It flew by in what felt like 8 weeks as opposed to 8 years.
If you look at someone like State Senator Stephen Weber, he entered the House when there were 70 Democratic members. That was back in 2009. You're at 52 now, which I'm pretty sure is probably the high point.
Yeah, it's a high point in my 8 years for sure.
How did the fact that the House Democratic Caucus remained stagnant in terms of numbers affect what you could do?
Our leverage really comes on certain specific issues. There's always two or three votes each year that Democratic votes are needed on. And so that's where we try to just exert as much leverage and influence as we can. This year and in years past, the video lottery terminal vote, whether or not to, sanction and legalize machines, that we see in these gas stations, these gambling machines, that's always coming down to one or two votes. There's been other votes over the years, tax credit votes, certain ones where Democratic votes are needed. The school voucher bill, actually, when it was first created, I think back in 21 or 22, whatever year that was, maybe it was 23, but not that long ago, that was a contentious issue that needed bipartisan support. And so, what we try to do is say, hey, look, these are the top priorities we care about, and we try to get as many of those as we possibly can, whether that's stopping something bad from happening or getting something good done. And we try to work as best as we can in those moments.
I will play devil's advocate on this point. When the Democrats had more members, I sort of felt that the Republicans really didn't want to give them wins on anything because the margins were so close.
Right.
And they didn't want to give people in swingy districts like a win that they could potentially use to win re-election.
Mm-hmm.
Did you kind of find that was just not as apparent because the Republicans never felt they were going to lose the supermajority or lose anything tangible. So they just sort of let the Democrats do what they wanted within reason.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think it's probably, given the lopsided dynamic, we probably were permitted to have, several more wins probably than we otherwise would have been permitted to have. You know, it was never a problem in my 8 years getting bills referred to committee, having hearings, getting bills on the floor, adding amendments on the floor. You know, if we presented an issue for open debate and we were able to get 50% plus one, then we were able to get it. And, you know, that was for the most part my experience, which, you know, that side of having a lopsided majority, I guess, is probably the only silver lining.
So you were elected in 2018, which was 3 years after same-sex marriage became legal everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think it also was at a span of time when having LGBTQ members like yourself in the legislature just was not as unusual as it was mm-hmm. maybe in the 2000s or even the 2010s. But did you still get people who said weird things to you or said that you're going to hell because you're gay? Or did that dynamic just not really exist?
I mean, there wasn't any sort of outward animosity, but, you know, just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had an open debate with the budget chair, Dirk Deaton, on the floor of the House during the budget committee, asking him if he thought the school voucher money that was going to private schools that blatantly, overtly, discriminate against LGBT. They say it on their website. They say it in the mission statements. We're not going to accept LGBT families. We're not going to accept kids with gay parents. We're not going to accept gay identifying students. We're not going to hire gay teachers. And I said, do you think my employment in one of these schools should be prohibited based solely on my sexual orientation? And essentially he said yes. He was too embarrassed to just say yes in the microphone. But of course, in his long-winded answer, he said yes. And so the weird thing that happens is people like Dirk, like Ann Kelly, like so many other folks I've talked to and gone to combat with over the last 8 years is, oh, I really respect you. It's not about you. You know, really the definition of respect, I think I have one and they have the other.
Yeah, I think what is notable is that when you started, I think the predominant issue was the fact that you can get fired or evicted from your house mm-hmm. or just discriminated because of your sexual orientation or gender identity, and there can be no legal recourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was like the main thing that a lot of both straight people but also LGBTQ legislators were talking about. Then it just became a lot about transgender issues,
right.
About can they play sports? Should they be able to get certain medical care? We even had a brief time period where adults who were transgender may not have been able to get hormone therapy or gender transition surgery, something mm-hmm. that was Andrew Bailey liked,
right.
But was so extreme that even Mike Moon and Nick Schroer and Andrew Koenig thought was way too far.
Right.
You probably noticed this shift. Like, mm-hmm. how do you think that has sort of shaped attitudes about LGBTQ people when it's been all about transgender issues?
Yeah, it has shifted. You know, when I remember proposing those amendments for the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act on the floor and debating them and arguing them on the floor, and we certainly had bipartisan support for those. Mike Parson, when he was a state senator in the state Senate, was supportive of the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. We had, you know, we were really honestly close to getting it done. We had really broad bipartisan support for a pro-LGBT bill. That then quickly transitioned, because of the national debate around transgender issues, quickly shifted into attacking specifically transgender children, but like you said, also adults who want to, by the way, decide what gender they want to place on their driver's license. You know, it went to attacking transgender people. You know, we were winning on LGB, and so they pivoted to the most vulnerable group in our community and started attacking them, transgender children. And as they did that, just like we can see bear out in national polls, my conversations with folks who were otherwise supportive of me being in a gay marriage, of the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act passing, I saw their support for those issues slip as they just dug into this anti-transgender sentiment.
Former Senator Greg Razor predicted that in 10 to 15 years from now, people will look back at legislation aimed at trans people the same way that we look back at the 2004 Missouri gay marriage ban, as cruel, pointless, and socially backwards. Do you think that's actually the case?
Yeah, I do. I think folks will realize that it's not a threat to them. That was the case in our, you know, right? We were destroying the sanctity of marriage. We were going to indoctrinate all these children into wanting to someday be gay married too. When people realized that that wasn't actually a real thing, that wasn't actually true, we weren't actually a threat, their marriage was going to survive fine. You know, our marriage wasn't going to impact their child's decision whether or not to get gay married and, you know, someday down the road. The same will happen with these issues as well, I think.
You came to the legislature from an educational background. Mm-hmm. I think you worked for Robin Carnahan
really
early in your life.
Yep.
But I think you taught at a school.
Yes.
Like for more period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the biggest global conflict in Missouri educational politics has been about keeping the public school system in Missouri largely static versus expanding
yep.
state support and recognition for charter and private schools. First of all, do you think that is the actual conflict, or do you think there's more to that?
Well, I think static is the right word, and maybe not in the way that you're saying it. I think my biggest frustration as someone who's been on the K-12 Education Committee almost every year I've been down there, who's gotten the bulk of the work I've gotten done and signed into law has been issues related to education. My biggest frustration is the public school system begging for the status quo, with the exception of maybe wanting more money, protecting and guarding the static status quo as if that is the preferential, when in fact there are so many more reforms we need to be making to our public school system. And so, you know, when I first got down there, I was pretty friendly to public school open enrollment, but I was not really on the charter school bandwagon. I certainly wasn't on the school voucher bandwagon. After these last several years, my mind is so much more open to changing the system.
Why?
Because of the protection of the status quo from these public schools.
Yeah.
We have 518 districts, way too many. Mm-hmm. We have got to consolidate our districts, both urban, rural, and suburban. It is mostly a rural issue, but it is all around our state. We have to allow certainly public school open enrollment. We're starting to now have a few public schools to understand how that might be beneficial for them, and they're starting to quietly get on board with that. Most of them, if they actually understood it and actually thought about it for 2 seconds, would like it too, but they are too busy protecting the status quo. They see everything as a threat, and it's incredibly frustrating.
But what about the charter school issues? You represent a district with Ladue, I guess maybe part of Maplewood, Richmond Heights.
It's just Clayton and Ladue right now.
Clayton and Ladue.
Yeah.
If I belonged to either one of those school districts, charter schools would not be something that I would consider for a millisecond.
Right.
Why would you even give a second thought to charter schools when it's something your district doesn't need, basically?
Yeah, for sure. And that was really my trajectory on that issue. When I came down there, you know, I was kind of pretty much in the pro-public school mode. And then I realized, oh, wait, I mean, I didn't know when I got elected that half of the kids in SLPS or the school district are educated at charter schools. That was a statistic I didn't have in 2019.
But are they educated well? Because a lot of them are being shut down, or they aren't seen as very well run.
Each charter school is just as different as each public school.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that SLPS does not have problems. I mean, I moved to St. Louis County because they don't have a special education program on par with St. Louis County.
Right.
But I think there's the argument that having the charter schools are kind of parasitic elements that make the public schools worse because they take money from them, which is probably what you heard a lot from them.
Well, I guess they're taking money from them if a student decides to go to a charter school instead of their school. But,
yeah.
But I, you know, and honestly, it was those first couple years when I was down there. And this is a shout out to anybody who wants to go to Jefferson City and make your voice heard. You really can. It really is impactful. Having parents from SLPS come and visit me, you know, often with tears in their eyes, often wanting to just grab me by the shoulders and say, I will drive my child to a different school. I just have to get them somewhere else. You know, don't let somebody tell you that, you know, this whole choice thing isn't going to affect people like me, because it absolutely is. They were parents of students with disabilities. They were families of color. They were people who were coming and saying, look, give me a choice. Let me take my child where I want to take my child in the system and expand my choices. And I came around to that argument.
So to drift into something even more controversial, because controversy is fun.
Yes.
You mentioned elsewhere that you are a strong supporter of Representative Haruza's legislation that requires schools to address anti-Semitism. Why did you support this? Because you heard this like 1,000 times, that this was just a backdoor way to ban criticism of Israel.
Sure.
We had Representative Haruza on the show. I highly recommend going back to our 2025 episode where he can explain it further. But it passed by a wide margin, but it was controversial. So what made you into that idea?
Yeah, well, I had the opportunity to travel to Israel with George back in September, and we got to talking. We, you know, really got along. We're working to figure out, you know, what we were going to work on in terms of this space. We worked on the legislation all summer. I was mostly interested in those reporting requirements for educational institutions. That was a part of, like I just mentioned, the 2021 legislation that I had. Once you require reporting of incidents where the media sees them, where a spotlight can be shown on them, where the department, whatever department it is in Jefferson City, can actually do something about it. That is an incentive for institutions to actually do everything they possibly can to reduce those incidents. And so that's what I wanted to see happen with this legislation. And I think that's what's going to happen now that it's become law.
So to be clear, I am against anti-Semitism because I don't hate myself, but I'm actually going to take this in a different direction. You probably were expecting us to relitigate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which we're not going to solve on this. I think the rise of overt anti-Semites like Nick Fuentes and more covert ones like Tucker Carlson, the problem is not that they're learning about that in school, but they're learning about that on their phones or on their computers, and they're going to be absorbing this information outside of school. So my question is, does reporting anti-Semitism or having this in place as a way to, like, maybe dispel people in schools from being anti-Semitic really going to solve anything if people are just being anti-Semitic outside of school?
Well, I think kids are going to take what they're doing and learning outside of school into school. I think they're going to repeat some of the things they might hear and see in a TikTok clip and try to, you know, print that out and for the public to view. So I think what happens outside of school often makes its way into school. And, you know, we've seen a lot of calming down around the sort of physical incidents. But, you know, we had a lot of physical incidents in our institutions. And you know, when we had the graffiti incidents and we had, you know, a number of different incidents take place in my district and around the St. Louis region. And, you know, it took quite a while, I think, for the Post-Dispatch to learn about and write about. And I think they were the first ones to actually publicly report on that graffiti incident. I mean, I think now, you know, there was the tornado that was right around the same time. But, you know, a lot of time went by before I even knew as the state representative that had happened in my district. And so reporting those incidents is really important.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll continue our politically speaking conversation with State Representative Ian Mackey. And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Representative Ian Mackey. He was formerly a Democrat from Richmond Heights, but now you're a Democrat from Clayton.
Right.
All right, let's talk city-county merger, because on the last show, you were like, let's talk a lot more about this on the next show.
Sure.
You're a supporter of this idea, correct?
I am, yep.
Were you a supporter of the Better Together plan?
I was.
Okay, do you think that the Better Together plan would have been better received if it didn't give ungodly amounts of power to Steve Sanger?
I think so. I think that, and, you know, at least for people on my side of the aisle, the whole Rex Ziegfeld issue, too, I think those two things combined. But I think, yeah, overall, probably the Sanger power consolidation was such a huge piece of it. But honestly, though, it was still just the taking of power away from 1,100 elected officials, which it was at the time, you know, a little bit fewer now. But, you know, really sort of just lessening, at least, the power of 88 different local mayors and so many alder people was also just, you know, a huge problem for people.
Do you think that the failure of Better Together poisoned the well for the conversation about city-county merger?
Well, it has for the last 8 years. Do you think, 6 years?
All right, before I get into the latest iteration, why are people so hesitant to use the term merger when we talk about this issue? Why is it a bad word? It is literally what...
Right.
Whether you're talking about Better Together or you're talking about taking city-county offices and putting them into the county, that is literally a merger.
Yep.
I don't understand why people get so hung up on this.
I don't either. Like, I don't either. Like, I use the term, and I get told not to use the term by people who want it to happen, and I don't understand it either, honestly.
Yeah, and some people are like, what I'm about to talk about, city joining the county as a municipality is not a merger. Yes, it is a merger.
It is.
You're merging county offices.
Right,
like,
right.
Literally.
Yep.
So, speaking of that, what do you think of St. Louis County Executive Sam Page broaching the possibility of the city becoming a municipality within St. Louis County?
I think it's great. I think that's a good start. You know, I think of two things. I think one, it really highlights, you know, when my inbox was full when I had, you know, was pushing my legislation last year and early this year with folks that, well, we can't have the county bail out the city. We can't have the county bail out the city. Well, why did Sam Page want the city to come into the county? Was it because we could use help from the city?
No, it's funny you mentioned that. I'll let you continue your thought. I went into the Board of Aldermen and I said hi to a bunch of people because I don't go in there as often as I did. And I'm like, hey, Sam Page wants you to join the county now. And they're all like, absolutely not. We're not bailing you guys out because the county is in really bad financial straits and the city is in less bad financial straits. But continue.
And we would be better off together, which absolutely. But I think it's really highlighted that issue for folks. I was able to write back to those folks and say, actually, you're making an argument from 10 years ago, not from right now. And here are the facts. And people appreciated those facts. And people started opening their mind to those facts who were in the county. And so, you know, so I like it from that regard. From the other, the reason why I say it's just a starter, just a step, though, is for me, it's never been about consolidating departments and saving money. That's a great thing that can happen. That's icing on the cake. Our problem is our national image. Our problem is our image that we present to the rest of the country. And bragging that we have one recorders of deeds offices instead of two is not going to bring people to our region. What's going to bring people to our region is presenting ourselves as a city of 1.3 million people that acts in concert, that does things in concert, that actually has regional cooperation, that works together, that prioritizes the same issues. That's what's going to bring people to our region.
Do you think that this idea of city joining the county that has been broached by somebody who's a lame duck and arguably not popular enough to affect popular opinion? I'm talking about Sam Page here.
Oh, I thought you were talking about me.
No, I'm talking, I mean, technically could be you. But I mean, Sam Page brought this up at the very end of his term. He never expressed any support for this until now.
Right.
So do you think that this isn't really helping move the ball? That he's talking about this.
Probably not. I mean, I think it's, yeah, and he's not running for re-election,
no.
Right? So, I mean, I get it if he was running for re-election, why he might sort of want to make this sort of, you know, his big idea for the future, but I kind of don't get the timing either.
So I see opposition on two fronts to any city-county merger idea. The first is from Republicans who would be forever locked out of winning any county-wide office. Now, you could be like, they're already locked out now.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
There are some Republicans that like the city-county merger idea. You mentioned Rex Singfeld.
Right.
I think he is probably a Republican if you asked. But that's going to be like a pretty insulated source of opposition. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think like so much of the opposition, I think elected Republican opposition is something you'll see. I think folks who are in elected Republican office will potentially see this as a sort of dilution of their partisan power within St. Louis County. And maybe to some extent they would be right about that. And I can empathize with that. But it's a really political argument that I don't think your average citizen is going to empathize
okay,
with.
Okay, so but here's the bigger one is African Americans. African Americans mm-hmm. have never liked the concept of a city-county merger idea because they feel it also dilutes their political power. And let's take St. Louis County off the table for a second, because yes, black candidates have been able to win countywide offices there, even though it's only 25% African American. But if you look at other cities that have what I would classify as a unigov government, where they did exactly what you mentioned about Better Together, Indianapolis, Louisville, Nashville, all white county executives, there's never come close to being a black elected official there. So I feel like that is actually a more tangible concern among black citizens if they want to have any chance of elevating a black person to a place of real political power. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to reduce the number of similar to the last two arguments. When you reduce the number of elected positions, you are going to get people in those elected positions who are angry. Will it reduce the number of black elected positions? Yes, because it will reduce the number of all elected positions. But does that reduce black political power? I don't think so. I think Brian Williams is going to be our next county executive, whether we merge or whether we don't. Wesley Bell was our county elected attorney before he went to Congress. Quentin Lucas has been the two-term mayor of Kansas City, which is not a majority black city at all.
Yeah, but Kansas City's political culture is so much different than St. Louis's, where like the white political class is willing to give tangible power to black people. Like that has not been the case in St. Louis. A lot of white people have like gripped on to power very aggressively to prevent black people from being elected.
And I don't think you're wrong about that, but that doesn't negate the fact that we just the two examples of Wesley Bell and Brian Williams. I don't think it's going to consolidate. Well, it is going to consolidate perhaps black political power, like it will consolidate so many other constituents groups' political power. But that is not to say that it's at all diluted.
I guess the other issue that was actually brought up by one of your former colleagues, former state senator and state representative Maria Chappelle Nadal, who is a supporter of the city county merger, but she pointed out, and this is the reason she didn't like Better Together, that she wanted to see a rigorous and independent financial assessment of whether any idea was actually going to do what the proponents said they were going to do. And the only financial documents we had were from in-house financial analysts.
Sure.
So that I happen to think that that is actually a really good point, and that if we do the city joins the county as a municipality idea, having a board of freeholders where they have city and county officials and they do like an independent study about what exactly the financial benefit or cost will be. I think that that's pretty reasonable, because if it's seen as like significantly more expensive for everybody, then I think it's going to fail because people are going to be like, what's in it for me?
Mm-hmm.
If they have a situation where all these county departments are going to have more money at their disposal and they're going to be able to hire more people or they're going to hire better people and you're going to have better service and, you know, all of our parks are going to be made of gold or something like that. Like, that could be a more convincing argument. Like, what do you make of that?
I think it's an impossible task. I don't think there's any we don't know what's going to happen.
No.
We just don't. And so I think what's going to happen is I get why we want that. We get fiscal notes. Maria, my friend, would know what a fiscal note is, having spent so much time in Jefferson City.
Yes.
We get them with every bill, right? And what do they often tell us? Well, the cost of this could range from $0 to $100 million. Because we don't know what's going to happen. So everything is just so dependent on a line of dominoes and how they fall. And so I just don't really – I get the want for it. I just don't think it would be effective.
So let's move on to something else you're really passionate about. I would say out of any Democratic elected official, you have probably been the most outspokenly negative about ballot initiatives in Missouri, which has been embraced by a lot of progressive activists to get policies into the state constitution. I think you said that you could wave a magic wand, you'd get rid of the IP process completely, right?
I would.
Why?
I am so tired of all of us as voters being able to have our cake and eat it too. I am sick and tired of issues being separated from representatives in government who are sent there to represent those issues. You know, we're seeing it on abortion, where we could potentially see it here on the tax referendum, which doesn't seem to be popular at all, right? Mike Kehoe ran for governor and got, 60%,
yeah,
saying, two issues is what I'm running on. I'm pro-life, and I want to get rid of the income tax.
And I want to put the state in charge of the police department, which, by the way, you voted for.
I did,
by the way.
Yes.
It's on your Wikipedia page.
Okay.
I don't know if you know that.
I do not know that.
But continue.
You know, he gets 60% of the vote, and then his top two issues, I mean, we don't know obviously what will happen with the tax issue, but by most accounts, very unpopular. Certainly with the abortion issue, Missourians were against him. So why did he get 60% of the vote? Well, because we got to have our cake and eat it too. The unions then endorsed him. He was the Senate architect. He wrote the right to work bill in the state Senate and then gets endorsed by unions. Why? Well, because we got those rights protected in another way. It drains resources from political campaigns, and it puts issues in a silo where they don't belong. We are sent to Jefferson City every 5 months because all of these issues are connected, and we are sent there to represent folks on these issues, and I'm tired of seeing them plucked out, set aside one by one.
Do you think that if there was no IP process, all the money that went to pass Amendment 3 or to kill right to work would have all gone to Crystal Quaid?
I sure hoped it would have.
Yeah. So, like,
I sure hope it
would have. Do you think like $30 or $40 million would have been spent even though it was not a DGA-targeted race?
I mean, I think if you've got St. Charles County and Jefferson County on a year where we have Prop A on the ballot, potentially voting for the Democrat that's going to protect their paycheck, yeah, I would sure hope you would see that.
I guess the counter-argument is that if we are in a state where Democrats can't win statewide office and they're going to be in the super minority, like, this is the only recourse any Democratic voter has to get rid of Republican policies they don't like. What do you make of that argument?
Well, it's their only recourse because we've trapped ourselves in that box. But because by not electing a Democratic governor because of the issues we just mentioned, by not expanding the majorities in the state, St. Charles County and Jefferson County should be sending, and all these other counties that, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you can look and see they elected pro-union Democrats for that particular issue. If we saw that again, things would be a whole lot different.
So do you secretly want the IP to make it basically impossible for any initiative petition, constitutional amendment to pass, Amendment 4? I think you probably voted against it,
yeah.
But I mean, that would basically kill the initiative petition process for constitutional amendment, but it would allow the legislature to put whatever they want on the ballot, basically.
Right.
So that really isn't what you want.
No.
You want it to just be gone.
Correct.
So would you want it to just be like Illinois, where it's just basically impossible to get anything on?
I mean, I guess, yeah. I mean, I think so. I like, but like you said, I don't like the idea of then the legislature just being able to, in a simple majority, put whatever they want on the ballot either. But no, I really would like to see folks decide who they're voting for based on the issues that those individuals represent. That is what we have to get back to. And if we got back to that, Democrats would have a whole lot more power.
So you're not continue.
And some of these are just terribly worded. Some of them are really just pats on the back. Is abortion really legal in Missouri right now, Jason? Is it really? Are women getting abortions in the state of Missouri?
That is a good question. I'm glad you mentioned that because there have been some people who really did not like the older Amendment 3 because of just the slowness it's taken to get to this point. There are things that you can do now, but you're correct because there's no medication abortions.
Folks who did that got to pat themselves on the back and say, oh my gosh, look, women have the right to abortion again. For how many millions of dollars did we get that slogan, that bumper sticker? What actually changed? And now here we are 2 years later, because you live in a state with the majority of people who are in elected office in Jefferson City disagree with you, that we're now going to have it on the ballot again. And then what are we going to do in two more years? Go try to pat ourselves on the back again with how many more millions of dollars? This endless cycle is vote for people in office that represent your issue. That is the way to get it done.
Let's move on to the future of the Democratic Party in Missouri. So President Trump's approval ratings are entering George W. Bush territory in 2006. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I'm comparing it to 2006. This is 20 years. It's my 20th year in Missouri political journalism. So I'm a little nostalgic about that. But it was a different Missouri back then, but Democrats ended up winning a U.S. Senate seat and three state Senate seats that year. Do you think that this is the year where the red state insulation just cannot withstand people being extremely pissed off about a war in Iran and $5 gas?
Yeah, I mean, the gas prices, my gosh, if I hear one more thing about gas prices, I'm just going to pull my hair out. The fact that more people care about gas going up $2 than they care about the protection of our democracy and what happened to those cops on January 6th. Like that I've had enough. I've had enough of the discussions about gas prices. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
I don't really want to talk about it either. But I'm just saying that when there's like actual when an economy actually hurts.
Yeah.
Voters, that's when you start seeing people that voted for Republicans vote for Democrats. Like, that's what happened in 2006.
Right.
But continue.
No, and I think where you're going to see that is where the parts of our state that are growing. And that's where you see Democrats typically win, even in redder or reddish states, is where there's an increase. Look what happened in Georgia, right? Why are we competitive in Georgia now? Well, because Georgia exploded in population. Where you're going to see Democrats perform well is in Lee Summit, where Carrie Ingalls running for the state Senate, down in Springfield, where Betsy Fogel's running. Those are places in our state where people want to be, where they're moving to. And when that happens, more often than not, the blue Democratic base grows.
So let's talk about those two races. So the Betsy Fogel versus Melanie Stinnett contest in Springfield. I think there's a lot of optimism for Fogel. The fundraising between those two is actually pretty even. And I think if the fundraising, if Fogel matches Stinnett in fundraising, which is probably unlikely because there'll be a lot of third party money comes in, I would guess she's the soft favorite just because the district composition is like 50-50, basically. And if it's a Democratic wave election, I'm not really sure there's much Republicans can do. Even though Melanie Stinnett seems, by all intents and purposes, to be a very strong candidate, too. Like, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's true. And I think, and this is something I also managed campaigns and was a campaign consultant for many years before this, too. And what I just try to tell folks is you've got to reach your saturation point. If you reach your saturation point, you're good. Your opponent can have 2 times, 3 times as much money as you. That's fine. Reach your saturation point. Get your message to who needs to hear your message. Make sure it's a good message that they're going to buy into. That's all you need to do. And I know that Betsy's going to do that, and I know that Carrie's going to do that.
Yeah, so the Carrie Ingalls race is a little bit more up in the air because John Patterson has to win his primary against former state representative Dan Stacey. And on paper, this really shouldn't be close. John Patterson has $3 million. I have no idea how much money Dan Stacey has, but not $3 million. But he's going to be able to – Dan Stacey is going to be able to run a primary campaign truthfully and saying, I am more conservative than John Patterson.
Yeah.
So I'm not willing to bet a dollar on my former Maneater columnist colleague winning.
Right. Yep, I wouldn't either.
And I'll just be brutally honest here. If Dan Stacey wins that primary, Carrie Ingalls wins.
Yeah.
I see no path to victory for him.
Yeah, same.
The question, though, is if John Patterson is the nominee and he has a $3 million or more and Carrie Ingalls maybe has $1 million, is this an instance where the wave is going to be so strong in an area of the state that is turning blue so quickly that it just the money disconnect doesn't matter here? Because in any other race, like, the $3 million person would win.
I don't think that's true. No, yeah. It's about how the $1 million person spends their money. This is one reason why people don't like politicians and the money in politics.
Yeah.
$1 million to reach 175,000 people, are you kidding me? $1 million is plenty enough money to reach 175,000 people. My God, the idea that we think we need $3 million for these state Senate races is insane.
Because nobody watches TV to see a state Senate race. It's all about mail.
And then you do the TV. Do your fun ad. Feel really good about it. Put the lights up. Okay? Yeah. But give me a break.
Yeah.
Go reach those 175,000 people with your $1 million. And if your message is better than your opponent's and the dynamics are somewhat in your favor, you will win.
Okay. So you're in the first congressional district still. Still under the new or old map?
Yes.
Okay. If the new map is in place, I'm in the first district, and we're going to save that conversation for later. I actually think a bellwether is the second congressional district. And this is going to be, I'm going to try to be as nice as possible here. There are a lot of Democrats in the second congressional district that underestimate Ann Wagner. They've been doing that since Cort Van Ostrand ran, and certainly when Jill Shoup ran. And I understand why Democrats don't like her, that voting record, doesn't do town halls, whatever. But she is like a phenomenally excellent politician. She would not still be there if she wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, if we're talking about a plus 11 Democratic blue wave, which is what the New York Times poll showed the other day, and it could change, it could go down to 6.
Sure.
It could go up to 15.
Yeah.
I don't know how Ann Wagner survives that. I just don't.
Yeah.
Am I wrong on that?
I mean...
Because hypothetically, Jill Shoup should have won.
Sure.
And Cort Van Ostrand should have won.
Sure.
Neither of them even won St. Louis County.
Sure.
So what's your thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think St. Louis County, sure, will go blue, of course. But, I think it depends on... I get this probably will be a bigger wave than those were years favorable to Democrats for sure, but I think this will be a year even much more favorable to Democrats because unfortunately gas prices, my God. But anyway, for whatever reason, it will be more favorable to Democrats. So there is that. But I think it also is a question, and I haven't thought about Congress in a minute, is trying to remember where St. Charles County is in this situation.
In the new district, it is not in it because the third district.
Right. So but that's where people are moving to. That's where it's growing. That's where Democrats are chomping at the bit. That's what would come along with the
wave. Which is interesting you mentioned that. And I've talked to Bob Onder about this. If in that new third district, which will eventually be the third district, like if it's not this year, it'll be in 2028 or 2031, I think that district is winnable for Democrats eventually if they could win St. Charles County outright,
because
they're going to get 60% of the vote in the city of Columbia. It has all of the city of Columbia in it.
Right.
So that district has the potential to be very swingy in the future.
Yep.
This cycle, I'm not sure it's quite there yet. So, okay, that you won't be here for that. Do you think your colleagues redistrict again and try to chop the first congressional district up into 5 districts?
I mean, there are certainly a strong sentiment of them that want to. There's a group of them that, tweet about it and talk about it and want it to happen. I would imagine that our governor probably won't do it until the call from the White House comes. And if that comes, of course, he will. That's what happened the first time around.
I mean, I still think doing what they did to the 5th district will eventually backfire on them. If the rural numbers go from 80-20 to 60-40, they could lose all 3 of those districts eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not this cycle. I don't know. The problem with doing the Mo 1 split is you have to split St. Louis and St. Louis County, and I would guess St. Charles County into like 5 different districts.
Mm-hmm.
And they would all end up being like plus 10 or plus 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take that big of a political shift to where all those districts turn Democrat in a blue wave.
Sure.
That's the reason Republicans like the first congressional district.
Sure.
They packed all the Democrats into one area to make the second and third unwinnable for Democrats.
Yeah.
Which is frankly kind of it makes me wonder, like, why are they even considering this when the status quo helps them the most, other than the call from the White House.
That's why. It's the service to dear leader.
Or I guess having majority black districts now is racist, according to Eric Schmidt. According to the Supreme Court.
I mean, according to the justices.
I don't think the first district is a racial gerrymander. I think it's a political gerrymander.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was you purposely put a bunch of Democrats into one district, happens to elect a black congressperson, and then elects 2 white Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I will push back against any Republican that says it's a racial gerrymander.
Right.
It had the effect of a racial gerrymander, but that is a subject for something elsewhere. Will you ever run for anything again?
I bet I will. Not in the immediate future, but yeah, it's been the great 8 years, and I'd like to do something like this again.
But what is it?
Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they'll have a statewide recorder of deeds.
Oh, now that sounds really boring, but maybe fun.
I mean, there's a really hot race in the city to become Shane. I was about to say Shane recorder of deeds.
Oh, Shane Cohn's seat. Yeah,
but,
right.
But there are more than just Shane Cohn running, and I mean. The issue is, like, you could have run for that state senate seat, but you didn't, and that could be occupied for the next 8 years.
Right.
And why would you subject yourself to county government? Because we kind of talked about how horrible it is.
Right.
You know, Governor Ian Mackey sounds nice.
I would take it if somebody gave it to me.
Well, I would too. Well, Representative, it's been a pleasure talking with you for the last 8 years. And as we say in the professional wrestling business, good luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can find all of our stories at stlpr.org. Are you on social media anymore? Or did you, like, get off of all the social media platforms?
I don't use it very often, but I am on Twitter at MoRepMackey. That's probably what I open and look at the most.
Well, I salute your self-control about not being on every social media platform because
yes.
It is very distracting. Until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.